Good day.
Today is Friday, 13th February 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this video. If once you've watched this video or whichever part of the video you want to watch, you decide that you like what you've heard and wish to indicate that fact. Now, in my programme yesterday, I discussed at some length the various steps which, according to either report or rumour, the Russians are making to assist Iran during its current ongoing crisis. And I mentioned the fact that the Russians, according to information I've received from within Russia, from a source who's provided reliable information in the past, are helping the Iranians to improve the accuracy and capabilities of their ballistic missiles, or at least some of them, that the Russians are also providing Iran with jamming equipment, presumably to help Iran deflect incoming American missiles, and that the Russians are also taking further steps, that they're moving troops closer to Iran's borders, presumably to Central Asia and those sort of places. Though I ought to quickly say that in relation to the last point, though I have definitely received reports about it, which, as I said, are, in my judgment, reliable, so far, I've seen nothing to confirm these troop movements in the Russian media itself. But that does not, of course, mean that they are not taking place. Anyway, there's been many reports, all of these reports taken together, that talk about this. A lot of it, as I said, is rumour. A lot of it is speculative. But some of it is there, out there in open sources. And some of it comes from a source I have found reliable in the past and whom I trust and who does have information which comes from Moscow itself. And I've discussed in many programmes the information this person has provided me with. So that's the Russians. But I also said that I understood that the Chinese were also involved, though I did not know the full extent of their involvement, other than the fact that they are providing satellite data to the Iranians. And this is hardly open to doubt, because the Chinese have been publishing photos of American bases in the Middle East made by their satellites. And they've been doing that in a way which already provides the Iranians with some published open source data which they might be able to use. Well, over the last couple of hours, I've learnt that, in fact, the Chinese assistance to Iran is very extensive and might actually go beyond the assistance that the Russians themselves are providing. Apparently, the Chinese have provided more radar sets to Iran, including very advanced 4D radars. I'm not quite sure what that means, by the way. But anyway, that's how it's been described to me. And these radars apparently are specifically intended to track the movement of aircraft at long ranges. And apparently they can also track stealth aircraft, or at least to some extent. So radar sets, almost certainly further equipment as well. But there is something that the Chinese are doing, which is apparently confirmed in open sources and which is apparently there on the internet, though I haven't been able to find it myself. But I don't doubt that this is the case. It's been confirmed to me by people who I know, and that is the Chinese spy ships are already in the Arabian Sea, keeping constant track of the movement and actions of the American force, the Abraham Lincoln, and its accompanying destroyers. And it's a reasonable guess that this information relayed by these Chinese spy ships to Beijing is then in turn relayed back to Iran, to Tehran, and to the authorities there. And there's also some rather intriguing reports that at a meeting in a Chinese embassy, perhaps the Chinese embassy in Tehran, or perhaps the Chinese embassy in Moscow, which I have very good authority, the Ali Larijani, Khamenei's national security advisor, visited during his trip to Moscow. Anyway, according to the reports I've heard, the Chinese actually showed the Iranians a model of China's J-20 fifth generation fighter jet and suggested to the Iranians that this might be a weapon system that they might in time be interested in. Now, I don't know whether this is true, but it is entirely plausible. And there is, by the way, a very good reason why it might make more sense for Iran to source fifth generation fighter jets from China rather than Russia. Russia's own fifth generation fighter jet, the Sukhoi 57, is now entering service in greater numbers. The Rostec, Russia's big arms manufacturer, the conglomerate that brings together Russia's military industries, delivered a rather big batch, as they put it, of Sukhoi 57s to the Russian Air Force. There's much discussion on the internet as to what a big batch amounts to. Some say 4. I've heard that it was 15. That, in fact, the Russians actually built 15 Sukhoi 57s over the course of 2025. That these are significantly updated aircraft with more advanced systems altogether. In fact, with the more advanced systems that are gradually coming into service, though apparently they still use the original Sukhoi 57 engine. There are 2 new generation engines developed in Russia. One of them, the AL-51, designed specifically for the Sukhoi 57. But apparently it has not yet been installed on Russian fighter jets. And that brings us directly to one of the issues, because the Chinese J-20 program is well in advance of the Russian program. The Russians have, depending on who you think is correct, between 30 and 50 Sukhoi 57s in service, operating either in service or entering service, some of which have been active in the battlefields of Ukraine. The Chinese already have hundreds of J-20s, and this is a more developed fighter jet. I'm not here to discuss which is better. I'm hardly the person to do that. But it is a more advanced program than the Sukhoi 57, and a more mature program than the Sukhoi 57. But there is a further factor which I think it's perhaps worth bearing in mind, which is that the Russians have striven at various times to maintain some kind of dialogue with Israel and have set themselves up at times as a broker between Israel and Iran, not a mediator. The Russians have never at any time sought to fulfill a mediation role, but they have at times put themselves forward and offered themselves as the party which could pass on messages between Iran and Israel. And according to Lavrov, that this actually happened in December when the Israelis and the Iranians supposedly, well, according to Lavrov, definitely via the Russians, came to an agreement with each other, an informal agreement with each other, which was that neither would attack the other unless the other attacked first. A kind of, if you like, informal non-aggression pact. So the Russians have sought to maintain a relationship with Israel. They have economic contacts with Israel, but perhaps more importantly, there is a significant Russian diaspora in Israel, which is quite significant in Israeli domestic politics, and which the Russians are sensitive about for various reasons, which I don't want to explore in this program. But anyway, the Russians have sought to maintain, as I said, some kind of dialogue with Israel, even as they've moved forward developing a very close dialogue with Iran. And as I remember some years ago, when discussions of Russian arms deliveries to Iran took place, this is quite a few years ago, but at that time, the Russians apparently assured Israel that though Russia would indeed supply weapons to Iran, they would be defensive, they would be defensive weapons, not weapons that Iran could use offensively, not weapons which Iran could use to attack Israel. Obviously, updating Iranian missiles, which do have the reach to hit Israel, bends that undertaking, bends it possibly to breaking point. But supplying fifth generation fighter jets, which undoubtedly do have the ability to reach Israel, well, that might be seen as basically going back entirely on that agreement and wrecking whatever prospect for a dialogue between Russia and Israel might exist. By contrast, China, which has a less intense relationship with Israel. This was not always the case, by the way. In the 1980s, as I very well remember, relations between China and Israel were quite close, but now they're much more distant. Anyway, China is not inhibited in the same way. And the Chinese and the Russians might even, for all I know, have come to an agreement with each other that if Iran does indeed need fifth generation fighters, it makes more sense at the moment for them to be provided by Iran, as by China, than it would be for them to be provided by Russia. This is all academic in terms of the existing conflict, because whichever fifth generation fighter jets Iran ultimately decides to acquire, this would be a very long-term program which presumably would require many, many years to be seen through. And it would take several years before Iranian pilots would acquire the level of proficiency needed to operate these fighter jets. But anyway, the fact that the Chinese are apparently or allegedly offering Iran J-20 fighters could be seen as a commitment by China to help Iran in this particular crisis. Now, having said all of that, ultimately, and in my opinion, if an attack does come, The big question will not be whether Iran is capable of defending itself militarily. It is how stable the internal situation in Iran remains. Iran was able to quell the protests that took place in January very quickly. But would it have that same ability if it came under attack by the United States? And I'm not here talking so much about protests in the streets of Iranian cities, but activations of militia forces that are said to be closely aligned with the United States. There's the MEK, which is regarded in Iran as an insurgent group and which has conducted violent acts over a long period against the Iranian government, and which has a curious ideology, but which is nonetheless very closely aligned to the United States, and which has apparently a training camp in either Kosovo or Albania, which is run by the United States. Apparently, that's the story, and which undoubtedly does have a presence in Iran. And one hears all sorts of stories about Kurdish militia in western Iran and Baluchi militia in eastern Iran, and some people are drawing all sorts of conclusions from a trip that was made recently by the US Vice President JD Vance to Armenia and Azerbaijan. My understanding, by the way, is that that particular trip was planned some time ago and that it isn't directly connected, or at least wasn't originally connected to the crisis in Iran. But then, of course, the agenda might have changed and there might be all sorts of things going on in the Southern Caucasus which are invisible to us who make these sort of programs. Though, to be clear, I cannot imagine that the Russians and the Iranians don't know all about them. But anyway, there's been all of these stories about all of these forces that could be activated. And well, again, I don't know enough to say how much of a threat to the Iranian authorities these various militias would be. It seems to me it all depends ultimately on how stable Iran's own internal security forces prove in this coming crisis. And by the way, I should quickly say that the crisis does indeed appear to be coming. Now, there are further reasons to think that the meeting between Netanyahu and Trump that took place a few days ago didn't go especially well. I've already said that it seemed to me as if Netanyahu was unhappy about the fact that the Americans are still conducting negotiations with Iran. He simply wants to move forward with a military attack on Iran. And perhaps it's worth pointing out at this point that Netanyahu, who is the Prime Minister of Israel, wants this attack to be carried out by the United States, not Israel. I mean, it's not Israel taking action, whatever action it considers it needs to take in its own defense. It is action taken by the United States on Israel's behalf at a moment when I personally am unable to see any proximate threat to the United States from Iran. But anyway, put that aside. Netanyahu has spoken about his meeting with Trump, and he said that while Trump continues to talk about the importance of negotiations with the Iranians, and I'm taking this from the Times of Israel, this is what Netanyahu said to the Israeli media at an air base in the United States as he was about to fly back to Israel. This is what Netanyahu is reported to have said. I do not hide my general skepticism about the possibility of reaching any agreement with Iran. Any agreement must include the components that are important to us, to Israel, and in my view also to the entire international community. Not only the nuclear issue, but also ballistic missiles and Iran's regional proxies. Interesting for me that Netanyahu here is in effect placing Israeli interests first ahead of those of what he says are the international community, even as he demands military action against Iran, highly, highly risky military action against Iran by the United States. But let's not get bogged down with that. But anyway, this suggests that Netanyahu and Trump did indeed disagree with each other. Trump's still talking about negotiating with the Iranians, telling Netanyahu that he wants negotiations to continue. After the meeting, Trump apparently told the US media that he wanted them, he didn't have an exact timeline, but that he expected, he thought that the negotiations should continue for roughly a month. And he does expect two or three further meetings, just saying. But he clearly does want a deal. And, well, as to what the terms of that deal will be, whether it will go as far as Netanyahu wants, well, that's, of course, another matter. Now, here I have to say that there's a number of things we need to keep in mind. Firstly, there were supposedly dissensions, disagreements between Trump and Netanyahu in the first half of 2025. And then during the 12-day June 2025 war, Donald Trump himself said that all of those seeming disagreements were simply subterfuge intended to lull the Iranians into a sense of complacency, to make them think that an attack on Iran was not actually coming, even as it was being planned. Anyway, some of us still have some doubts about that, but that is what Trump said. In light of that, we can't assume that this apparent disagreement between Trump and Netanyahu is for real. That's the first thing. But the second, far more important thing, is that the American build-up is now continuing on an enormous scale. Yesterday, there were reports that the United States has given instructions to another carrier group to prepare for possible deployment to the Middle East. Then later yesterday, we received reports that the Gerald Ford, the aircraft carrier and its accompanying destroyers that are deployed to the Caribbean, where they have been placing pressure on Mexico, on Venezuela, that carrier group is now being transferred to the Middle East, presumably to support the Abraham Lincoln and to prepare for war against Iran. Now, I understand, I haven't seen this confirmed definitely, but I understand that the carrier group that was told to prepare for deployment earlier yesterday is not the General Gerald Ford. It is a third carrier Some identified as the carrier George H.W. Bush, and that carrier also is apparently being transferred to the Middle East. At least that's what the reports say. Now, this is a colossal build-up. This would be three American carriers together with their accompanying destroyers. It would be a third of the US fleet. And as I understand it, it would be around two-thirds of the American fleet deployable in peacetime. The cost of such deployments would be enormous. And bear in mind that the crew of the Gerald Ford has been busy for quite a long time now, as has the crew of the Abraham Lincoln. What they think about this further deployment, I'm not going to even try to guess. They are professionals, presumably. They're accustomed to this sort of thing. But anyway, this is going to be very hard work for the crews. But the key thing is an enormous force is being concentrated against Iran. And there are reports that F-22 fighter jets are now being sent to the Middle East as well. The F-22 was the original fifth generation fighter jet developed by the United States in the 1980s. Some say that it is still more sophisticated and more powerful than the F-35. Again, I'm not going to discuss the which fighter jet is better. That's not for me to do. But anyway, the concentration of force by the United States against Iran is enormous. So the thing to say about this is that if all of these reports about China and Russia becoming involved are true, which I'm sure they are, what we are looking at here is a straight-out superpower confrontation. The biggest that has taken place since the 1973 Middle East War, when the parties confronting each other were the United States and the Soviet Union. In some ways, significantly bigger even than that, potentially a confrontation on the scale of the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. The forces that are being deployed are simply enormous. And, well, I wonder what is going on. And for the record, I think that President Trump supposedly asked his officials, the Pentagon, told them that he wanted a quick, short attack on Iran that would give him what he wanted, which is the immediate collapse of the Iranian regime. We're told that the Pentagon said that this was not possible with the present forces deployed to the Middle East. And it seems to me that what Trump is probably doing, even as he's trying to, what he's going through the motions of conducting diplomacy with the Iranians, is that he is instead at the same time using the period of the ongoing negotiations to triple down, deploying vast numbers of tankers and carriers and fighter jets to the Middle East. He's told he didn't have enough forces before, so he's now deploying the greater part of the operative US Navy to overwhelm the Iranians in whatever way he can. And the Russians and the Chinese, starting from a much lesser position, having to rely on the Iranians increasingly, are nonetheless doing what they can to counter this. Superpower confrontations like this can become extremely complicated and very dangerous. The contacts between the Soviet Union and the United States in 1962 and in 1973, to anybody who is familiar with those two crises, became very, very complicated indeed. And there were indeed worries about a nuclear conflict over the case of both. This time, it's not just two superpowers, it's actually three. So how this superpower confrontation will play out, that is an entirely different question. We will see what happens, but all the indications so far is that the Chinese and the Russians are indeed trying to draw a red line, trying to deter the Americans from this attack, that Trump himself sees this as a challenge, that he's trebling down. And as I said, we could be seeing over the next few weeks a confrontation on a scale that I don't even want to imagine. Spring 2026 looks like it's going to be extremely dangerous. Now, there is a potential other superpower confrontation also on the horizon. I've been speaking about Cuba, about the fact that Cuba, which is now facing, in effect, an oil blockade, really has no serious option but to turn to Russia for help. And over the last 24 hours, we have finally received confirmation that the Cubans have done exactly that. So yesterday, we had some comments from Peskov in Moscow, which confirmed that Russia is indeed involved in talks to supply Cuba with oil. And we've had those comments of Peskov's were partially reported in the Russian media, but the Cuban media is now writing about them in more detail. So this is taken from Granma, which is Cuba's official newspaper. It says that Russia is considering action to support Cuba in the face of the US blockade. The Kremlin confirmed on Thursday that it is holding talks with Cuba to finalize shipments of oil and petroleum products in a context marked by the tightening of the economic blockade imposed by the United States. And then we go on to read that Peskov, this is still from Granma, said Moscow is evaluating various energy support options. But he said that he wouldn't give details for understandable reasons. And then there's a quote from Peskov. Peskov, this has also been cited in the Russian media. Throughout these days, we have been in contact with our Cuban friends and have been discussing options to help them. Energy cooperation with Havana is part of a historical relationship of solidarity between Russia and Cuba. So that's Peskov, but the Russian embassy in Havana, which, by the way, occupies an astonishing modernist building built by the Soviets in Havana. Anyway, the Russian embassy has been much more explicit. It said that a shipment of oil and petroleum products is being prepared as humanitarian aid to alleviate the energy crisis facing Cuba. And then we're also told that, and this comes from Peskov again, that Peskov is not seeking a direct confrontation with the United States. We do not want any kind of escalation. But on the other hand, at the moment, we have virtually no trade with the United States. And this references the fact that Trump has warned the Russians, has warned everybody, anybody who wants to supply oil to Cuba, that if they do, the United States will retaliate by imposing sanctions upon them. So Peskov said, well, we're not looking for a confrontation, but if the Americans are only looking at tariffs, well, what difference is that going to make? Because ultimately, we have virtually no trade with the Americans anyway. So this threat to impose sanctions, to impose tariffs upon us if we supply oil to Cuba, is a completely empty one. And that was said by Peskov. Now, when talking about confrontations between Russia and the US over Cuba about oil, it's important to say that it's obviously not just tariffs. The United States is trying to maintain some kind of energy blockade of Cuba. And as we have seen, there has been a big American fleet stationed in the Caribbean, and that fleet has sought to capture tankers which have been trading with Venezuelan oil, including one particular tanker, the Marinera, which had a Russian owner based in Crimea, though, as I discussed at enormous length, the Marinera itself was not a Russian ship and was not originally registered in Russia. I'm not going to revisit that topic. Well, when Peskov talks about not wanting confrontation with the United States, I suspect that what he also is signalling is that the Russians do not want a clash, a direct clash with the US Navy on the high seas. So they don't want Russian tankers supplying oil to Cuba to be seized by the United States on the high seas. If necessary, they might provide them with naval escorts. We've seen that the Russians are prepared and willing to do that. Of course, the US Navy is far more powerful than the Russian Navy. Even if the Gerald Ford is redeployed from the Caribbean, the US can still deploy more naval assets to the Caribbean than the Russians can. In every area of naval force, except, by the way, nuclear submarines, where the Russians have, if not an advantage in terms of numbers, certainly very powerful forces to reckon with. But I suspect that what is actually going on is that the Russians, even as they're working out plans about sending tankers to Cuba with oil to relieve the oil shortage there, are also trying to get the Americans to agree not to interfere with those tankers. Now, given that the United States, or at least the current administration, seems very determined to overthrow the government of Cuba and to provoke an internal crisis in Cuba, that might be extremely difficult. And I can't help but think that the Russians, in return, must be prepared to offer the Americans some kind of quid pro quo. I doubt that it is about the wider relationship, but probably the Russians are giving the Americans some assurances that oil deliveries to Cuba will not mean any larger military footprint, for example, by Russia in Cuba. Anyway, this is a complex affair, and it's also one that might turn out wrong. We shall turn out dangerous. Given the head of steam that has worked up in the United States over Cuba in the last few weeks, given the things that Trump himself has said about Cuba, I do wonder how he will respond to the sight of Russian tankers loaded up with oil, steaming towards Cuba, seeking to end his blockade of that island. Anyway, we shall see how that plays out over the recent next few weeks. But again, it is interesting that the Russians are starting to take counter steps. Now, of course, the biggest area of conflict between the United States and Russia remains the conflict in Ukraine. And quite a lot has been taking place in relation to this conflict over the last few weeks. Firstly, as we know, there's been the dialogue, the three-party talks between the Russians, the Americans, and the Ukrainians. And we've had two sessions of those talks in Abu Dhabi. Now, today, Peskov announced a third. And interestingly, it is not going to happen in Abu Dhabi. It is going to take place in Geneva. The Ukrainians clearly were not happy about meeting the Russians in Abu Dhabi or in Istanbul. They have been trying to get the talks transferred to the United States. I always thought that the Russians would be very unlikely to agree to that. And it does seem as if the Russians have said categorically no. This time, the talks are going to take place in Geneva. Now, the Russians have made it very clear that they don't consider Geneva, Switzerland, Geneva is, of course, in Switzerland, to be a neutral party any longer. But the Swiss have been making an effort to try to mend fences with Moscow over the last couple of weeks. The Swiss foreign minister, Ignacio Cassis, was recently in Moscow. It's extraordinary how little attention his visit has attracted. He went there nominally as head of the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, to which Russia remains, by the way, a very uncomfortable party. But anyway, he went there on that basis. But my guess is he was also probably trying to patch things up with the Russians, because to say this simply, and this has been widely discussed by Swiss commentators on the internet, in Switzerland, this departure from the Swiss policy of neutrality has been deeply unpopular and controversial. But perhaps more importantly, I suspect that it has also had repercussions for Switzerland in the wider world as well. So the Swiss will have tried to reassure the Russians that talks in Geneva can take place, and they can take place in the normal way and in the way that they used to do, and that the Swiss will make sure that unwanted parties, the British, the Europeans, people like that, will indeed be kept away. So the Russians have agreed that this meeting should take place in Geneva, where, by the way, just for the record, the Russians own various extremely attractive properties, and where they have, because of the historic importance of Geneva as a place to meet with various interlocutors, where they have lots of very secure facilities so that they can communicate with Moscow, and where they can keep their delegations comfortable, just to say. So anyway, this meeting will take place in Geneva. And the other interesting thing about this particular meeting is that there's been a change in the makeup of the Russian delegation. The two previous delegations were made up exclusively of military and security officials. The Russian delegation was led by Admiral Kostyukov, the head of Russian military intelligence. We were never told who the other officials who made up the delegation were. This time, the delegation head is going to be none other than Vladimir Medinsky, Putin's aide, culture aide, a historian, the same official who led the Russian negotiators who spoke to the Ukrainians in February and March and April 2022, the same chief negotiator who negotiated with the Ukrainians the original April 2022 Istanbul Agreement, which the Ukrainians and the Russians both initialed, but which the Ukrainians, at the urging of Boris Johnson, the British, the Europeans and the Americans, then walked away from. And the same Medinsky, who headed the Russian delegation at the meetings in Istanbul, the three meetings in Istanbul, which began in May of last year and which continued over the course of the summer. So why is Medinsky taking over as the chief Russian negotiator in these talks in Geneva? Well, I think, first of all, that there may very well be, plausibly be, a practical reason. As we know, last week, the Ukrainians, I have no doubt it was the Ukrainians, attempted to assassinate Lieutenant General Alexeyev, Kostyakov's senior deputy in Russian military intelligence, and quite possibly one of the Russian negotiating team at the meetings in Abu Dhabi. Now, quite apart from anything else, it would be entirely unsurprising if Kostyakov is absolutely furious and doesn't want to meet with the Ukrainians himself. He's a highly trained intelligence officer, but that doesn't mean that he isn't a human being. And sitting across a table from the people who tried to murder his deputy and probably his friend is probably something he does not want to do. Beyond that, there is the further factor that Kostyakov presumably is very busy at the present time trying to limit the damage to Russian military intelligence. Without Alexeyev, significant parts of the organization probably require Kostyakov's personal attention. For all I know, Kostyakov is taking charge of Alexeyev's department. At the very least, he's going to have to reassure the officials of Russian military intelligence and sort out and stabilize the organization in the light of what has happened. But putting all that aside, and this is it, these are plausible reasons why it might be the case that Kostyakov is not being sent. The decision to send Medinsky might also be a way for the Russians to start to move the issue back to the kind to the political agenda, which up to now the Ukrainians and the Americans have not wanted to talk about. Medinsky has turned out to be, over the last year, an exceptionally tough negotiator. He has all the facts at his fingertips. He's been somebody who's been involved in Ukrainian matters for a long time. He headed, after all, the Russian delegation that met with the Ukrainians in 2022. The Ukrainians have developed an intense dislike of him. I think hatred might not be too strong a word. There have been many, many criticisms and much mockery of Medinsky from the Ukrainians and from the West, Mark Rutte in particular, was unbelievably rude about him, making him out to be a so-called historian, calling him a so-called historian and a person of no significance in the Russian system, which is, of course, nonsense. All of that, by the way, in itself shows that the Ukrainians find him an extremely difficult person to work with. And I wonder whether, after the various discussions and debates that have been taking place in Moscow over the last few weeks, going back to the Valdai attack in December, whether somebody in Moscow, somebody who must, of course, include Putin, whether they've decided that the time has come to bring out the tougher, more forceful figure, the political, the person who understands the politics. It's time to get away from discussions about ceasefires and all of that that will never happen, and time to get back to the real serious issues, which is Ukraine's withdrawal from Donbass, Russian claims to the four territories, the entire agenda of Istanbul Plus, the restoration of the rights of the Orthodox Church, the restoration of the rights of Russian speakers, Ukraine's neutrality, all of those things. And that's why the heavy hitter, Medinsky, is now being wheeled out again. I don't think the Ukrainians will be happy that he's coming. What the Americans think, I don't know. It will be interesting to see who does turn up from the American side to the talks in Geneva. Will it be Witkoff and Kushner again? Will it be Rubio this time? It is astonishing that neither the Russian Foreign Ministry nor the State Department have been involved in the negotiations up to this time. Anyway, we shall see. But I've discussed in recent programmes the extremely forceful series of statements that have been made by Lavrov over the course of the last week. Day after day, he's been pounding the TV stations, and he's been talking to the media in Moscow, setting up an extremely tough position from the Russian side and making absolutely clear Russian disappointment, or rather maybe disappointment, anger is perhaps a better word, at the way in which the Americans have retreated from whatever it was that they promised to the Russians in Anchorage. And it seems to me that the decision to wheel out Medinsky is a clear sign of this. That's not to say that the Russians, some Russians at least, are not busy trying to follow other tracks. Dmitriev and Witkoff continue to meet, and Dmitriev has apparently put forward a series of proposals about how economic cooperation between Russia and the United States might work if the sanctions were ever one day lifted. I don't believe anybody expects these proposals to be implemented. But anyway, there they are. They've caused some eyebrows to rise in Russia. They've caused some eyebrows, I suspect, to rise in the United States. But as I said, to my mind, what they are essentially is a package presented to the Americans telling them, look, this is what could be achieved. You've made a huge mistake by going up against us. Is Ukraine really that important to you? If it is, well, this is what you're losing, and, well, it's your decision at the end of the day, not ours. A very Russian approach to negotiations. Meanwhile, of course, the war goes on, and we had that enormous combined Russian missile and drone strike that took place a few days ago, which has done massive damage to Ukraine's energy system. I think I read that Klitschko, the mayor of Kiev, is now saying that something like 3,000 apartment buildings in Kiev are without heating. Now, I didn't know that there were that many apartment buildings in Kiev, and it may be that I'm making a mistake here. I have particular difficulty sometimes reading numbers, and it may be that he's talking about 300 apartment buildings, because 3,000 does seem extraordinary. But anyway, Klitschko is talking about a tremendous emergency across Ukraine. The situation in Kharkiv appears to be even worse, and there is an energy disaster now playing out across Ukraine, and the situation economically is desperate. There was a meeting of Ukraine's Western backers in Rammstein in Germany, which has just ended. Once upon a time, Rammstein meetings used to be extremely important. We all used to wait to see what new aid packages the West would come up with. It was at the Rammstein meeting in early 2025, for example, that all sorts of pledges were made to provide Ukraine with all of the tanks and armoured vehicles which Ukraine supposedly needed to conduct its great offensive in the summer of 2023, the offensive which ended in complete disaster. Anyway, this time the Rammstein meeting appears to have come up with absolutely nothing. I say nothing. Ukraine's been apparently going to be given another $3 billion. I'm not sure what that is intended for, but presumably it enables Zelensky to keep people happy in Kiev, the political class happy in Kiev for a few more weeks. Notice, by the way, that we hear nothing more about the corruption scandal in Kiev any longer. Just saying. And the German defense minister, Boris Pistorius, said that Germany would provide Ukraine with 5 more Patriot missile interceptors, provided other Western countries provided Ukraine with 30 more Patriot missile interceptors as well. He spoke about a 5 plus 30 formula. Well, I mean, if that is true, that is ridiculous, given that the Russians launched 24 Iskander ballistic missiles over the course of a single strike, the last big one that took place. Perhaps Pistorius means something else, but what it is, again, exactly, I am not fully sure. But anyway, Rammstein doesn't seem to have come up with anything. The Munich Security Conference is also about to happen. And again, even as I talk about how Rammstein seems to have lost all significance, it's even more true about the Munich Security Conference. I will never forget the Munich Security Conference of February 2022. All of the leaders of the West were there in their pomp. The only person who didn't turn up was Biden. He sent Kamala Harris instead. But Boris Johnson, Olaf Scholz, Emmanuel Macron, they're all there. And of course, Zelensky was all there. And I remember the extensive excitement, the energy of the meeting, the extraordinary and unbelievably unbalanced speech that Zelensky made, in which he appeared to float the possibility of Ukraine eventually acquiring nuclear weapons, a speech which went down very badly in Moscow and which reputedly hardened the Russian decision to begin the special military operation. But it was clear that there was huge excitement and huge anticipation as the enormous sanctions that were going to pulverize the Russian economy were being worked out, probably even as the meeting in Munich was taking place, presumably in the corridors. How things have changed. Now we have Friedrich Merz coming along saying that the old order has gone. He's just made a speech to this effect, that fairly openly criticizing the United States for breaking the rules. Wolfgang Ischinger, the director general of the Munich Security Conference, has published a report which seems to me to be another long whine about the Americans and the fact that they're not acting as people like him, Ischinger, want them to. Rubio is there. Vance this time is not coming. Rubio has brought a strong delegation, we're told, though I'm not sure what that really amounts to. But anyway, they're all there, but one gets, and Zelensky also is going there. But there is none of that energy and none of that excitement and none of that, frankly, unconcealed euphoria as they all prepared to pull down Russia with sanctions, confident, I have no doubt, that the sanctions would precipitate a collapse in Russia in a few weeks or months at most. Anyway, there's none of that excitement, none of that eager anticipation, none of that sense of exhilaration at the Munich Security Conference this time. And Politico is telling us that there will be no important decisions made about Ukraine, and that the Trump administration has again made it clear to the Ukrainians that the United States is in no mood to give Ukraine security guarantees until there is a final settlement of the conflict, and that the United States still expects the Ukrainians to move forward with that by withdrawing from Donbass. As to that, Zelensky himself gave another long interview, this time to The Atlantic, a neocon journal, on steroids, by the way, and one which, for all sorts of reasons, is unpopular with some of the people in the Trump administration. just to say. Anyway, over the course of it, Zelensky again seemed to rule out any suggestion of Ukraine making any compromises. He again spoke about how a bad peace was something he could never present to his people, better to continue the war, however hard that might be, rather than accept the kind of dictated peace that the Russians, and by implication, the Americans also supposedly are demanding. The Atlantic says that some other Ukrainian officials are now in private saying that Ukraine might actually be willing to withdraw from Donbass after all in return for security guarantees. But that's certainly not the impression I got from Zelensky's own interview. And by the way, and for the record, he continued to insist that Ukraine is not losing the war. On the contrary, it is fighting and holding back the Russians successfully. Now, Zelensky's former press officer, Yulia Mendel, has, I think, answered this superbly. She has written another post on social media. She says that under the guise of lofty talk about peace, democracy and European values, world politicians and their followers are effectively condemning an entire nation to deterioration. 40 million Ukrainians, whatever remains of them after years of war, emigration and loss, are being plunged into darkness, cold and poverty. Despite the endless stream of experts, and she puts the word experts in quotation marks, patriotic bloggers and official spokesmen who keep telling the world about Ukraine's unbreakable spirit, and that's also in quotation marks. The myth collapses the moment you speak with ordinary Ukrainians. And of course, one of the people who talks in that way was the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, who, as I discussed in recent programs, went to Ukraine last week, went to Kiev last week, and also spoke there about the unbreakable spirit of Ukrainians. And then Mendel makes a very interesting point. She says that whatever the real population of Ukraine is at the moment, or to be more precise, whatever number of people there are in Ukraine at the moment, and she certainly does not believe that it comes anywhere close to 40 million, though she's careful not to give a number. She says that a large part of the actual population, the living people in Ukraine now, are pensioners who survive on tiny pensions. And she talks about how, following the Russian missile and drone strikes and the collapse of the Ukrainian energy system, she asks, how are these people supposed to live? How are these people supposed to survive the winter without stable electricity, heating, or adequate food? The humanitarian crisis is total. One of the recent stories caused a shockwave around the media and movie community. A Ukrainian film director died at home from cold and hunger. How many more such cases are there? And then she talks about the plight of members of her own family in Ukraine. And she says, when you hear yet another statement about the resilience of the Ukrainian people, it is a complete lie. Ukrainians have long been asking, how much longer must we endure? And they are enduring with their last strength. And she also says that more and more people of working age are losing trust. The demographic crisis is accelerating. The National Bank forecasts another outflow of 200,000 people this year alone. Real numbers are always higher. Public debt has crossed 98 to 100% of GDP. The IMF deal hangs by a thread. It's incredible, by the way, that the IMF continues to lend money to Ukraine. It does so, just to say, in total violation of its own charter, but I'm not going to dwell on that. The new laws risk inflating the shadow economy and pushing even more people to leave. The government is in despair. There is almost no money for anything except the army. The only thing that reliably works is corruption. It has become virtually the only stable business in the country. And she asks the question, yet do we hear about it in the media? Today, the main topic is whether elections can or cannot be held in Ukraine, politics that have lost all contact with people, analysis of statements, intrigues and sources instead of real human suffering. And she's absolutely correct. She's completely right about all of these things. Another big Russian missile strike is undoubtedly being prepared. The Ukrainians have conducted more strikes against Russia. They seem to be making a particular attempt to strike at Volgograd. I'm not sure why. It is indeed the case that Volgograd is a major centre of the Russian military industrial complex. It's said that there are missile factories there. But as we have seen, these drone attacks by Ukraine do only minimal damage. Apparently, the Flamingo missile, Zelensky's prized Flamingo missile, the one that looks like a German V1 cruise missile from the Second World War, that was launched against Volgograd We've actually been provided with video of the launches. The Russians say that five of these missiles were shot down. supposedly six were launched. There's some claims that one got through. I think it's more likely that there were only five, or if one ever did get through, that it probably did minimal damage, or perhaps even more plausibly crashed somewhere along the way. But anyway, even if one did get through, what difference is it going to make? We're talking about one missile against one of the world's biggest, most advanced, most resilient, most widely dispersed, most efficiently managed military industrial complexes. One missile, whereas the Russians, in their last strike, launched 24 Iskander missiles, and I'm going to express my own opinion, all of them got through. And they also launched their Kinzhal missile against the electricity substation close to Lvov. And there is apparently now a lot of activity in Kapustin Yar, and the Ukrainians themselves are now saying that an Oreshnik strike, such as I discussed in a recent program, looks like it is indeed on its way. The Russians can shoot down a Flamingo missile. They would have no difficulty. The Russian air defense system would find it a relatively straightforward missile to shoot down. It does have a large warhead. If it impacts on a target, it will do damage, significant damage. It is not remotely comparable to an Oreshnik, and frankly, I don't think it can do even the amount of damage that an Iskander does. Anyway, that is the reality in Ukraine. There are also reports that more and more Western governments now are starting to have doubts about the 90 billion euro loan. That doesn't surprise me at all, just to say. And that too, for the many reasons that I've talked about, I don't think is going to materialize anytime soon. Now, on the Durand, we did a detailed analysis with Stanislav Kaprivnik of the state of the military situation on the battlefronts. I expect that will be out fairly soon. What I will say at the moment is that, again, having now that the claims about the successful counterattack in Kupiansk by Ukraine are melting away, with more and more signs that the Russians not only control most of Kupiansk or all of Kupiansk itself, but that they have eliminated all of the pockets east of the Oskol River, except for one village that they still have to capture. Anyway, now that the story of the Kupiansk offensive can no longer be sustained, we have the Zaporozhye offensive, though it is not an offensive close to Orekhov or Guliapolye. It is supposedly taking place in very much the areas where Radovka continues to say that the Ukrainian attacks have been unsuccessful. And again, we have claims about enormous Ukrainian advances, all sorts of villages supposedly having been captured or recaptured by the Ukrainians. None of them particularly big, incidentally, just to say. Except, of course, that all of these claims, which again, far too many people, in my opinion, are accepting as either true or likely true. All of these claims are unsupported by any video evidence so far that I have seen. It's perhaps worth pointing out that around 70% of the video evidence that used to come from the war, used to come from the Ukrainian side. I believe that the proportion has fallen and that the proportion of video footage released by the Russians has increased, just to say. But I still get the sense that most of the videos that circulate do indeed come from Ukraine. And to repeat again, if the Ukrainians really were achieving the successes they claim, given the enormous importance they place on public relations, I would expect them to be releasing video footage immediately. The fact that they are not doing so, to my mind, casts significant doubt on their claims. Elsewhere, the situation remains unchanged, which is to say that the Russians are continuing their advance. It seems that near Liman, a village, important village called Drobyshevka, is close to being captured by the Russians. It's widely assumed that its fall will lead quickly to the capture of Liman itself. The situation in Konstantinovka has been described as another meat grinder. In other words, a situation where the Ukrainians pour reinforcements in to hold undefendable positions, only to be, well, ground down by the Russians, who control now all of the supply roads and who are deploying more and more forces to Konstantinovka itself. I remain of the view that Liman will fall this month, and I remain of the view that Konstantinovka probably will also. And anyway, all of these moves, the attacks on the energy system, the power blackouts, the attacks, the Russian advances, the extraordinarily tough statements from Lavrov, perhaps the appointment of Medinsky, and the continued silence of Putin himself, they all speak to me increasingly of the Russians preparing for a big offensive. And I understand that the Russians have around 350,000 additional troops close to the area of the contact line that have not yet been committed to the battle. All that is needed is the order to activate them. And I have to say that their presence, assuming that it is indeed there, which I am sure it is, does make me wonder whether these forces, all of these forces, aren't gathering in preparation for the big offensive that is coming. Anyway, let's wait and see. Soon it will be the spring thaw. After that, the brighter, sunnier weather comes, the ground will harden, and the ability to move large forces, well, the ability is already there, but the conditions to move very large forces will ease. And if that's what the Russians want to do, presumably it is what they will do. It is presumably what will happen. Now, of course, the narrative in the West continues to be of a Russia that is running out of men and machines on the battlefronts. Not that there is any sign of this. Nobody who is looking at the situation objectively can see it. There's been a very interesting article by Simplicius the Thinker, who has been analysing the various military the various intelligence reports about Russian artillery production, which I touched on in a recent program and who has also looked at the situation, the various analyses that have been done by various other commentators based on this situation about artillery shell production in Russia. Anyway, Simplicius the thinker has worked out that except in one specific area, which is in Zaporozhye, which is precisely the area where the Ukrainians are supposed to be carrying out this counterattack, where there appears to be rough equality in terms of artillery use between the Ukrainians and the Russians. Everywhere else, the Russians now have an enormous advantage. He puts it at 20 to 1 in some parts of the battlefronts, 50 to 1 in one or two places. And he points out that the same report, the same intelligence reports, talk about enormous increases in production by the Russians of artillery barrels. So there's no shortage of guns to launch these missiles. And for the record, it is a while now that I've heard of large transfers of artillery by the West to Ukraine, which is unsurprising because of enormous artillery shortages across Europe. In fact, some months ago, I actually got a report, I actually got a private email from, again, a reliable source who told me that Ukraine is now so short of guns, of actual guns, that most of the artillery, in order to preserve it, is being husbanded on the west bank of the Dnieper, far away, in other words, from the front lines. Well, that may or may not be true. I suspect it is true, by the way. But anyway, that's what the intelligence figures say. So there is no sign of any weakening on the front lines, nor, in my opinion, in fact, definitely not, is there any sign of any weakening in terms of Russia's economy. It's, again, remarkable how in every discussion of the state of Russia's economy, the narrative changes. A year ago, it was all inflation and overheating. Now the inflation is falling fast. People talk about it less. They talk about instead a decline in the pace of growth, even as growth across the European economies is at a complete stop, and in Germany appears to be registering an actual decline. In any event, today the Russian central bank shaved 50 base points of Russian interest rates. They've gone down from 16% to 15.5%. We're promised further cuts in interest rates over the course of this year. Inflation will return, according to the central bank, to its 4% target this year. And starting from the midsummer, economic growth in Russia will resume at a higher pace again. I would just say that this very gradual reduction of interest rates by the Russian central bank contrasts sharply with the practice in the West. In the West, if inflation were falling as quickly as it currently is in Russia, then interest rates would also be falling faster as well. Interest rates in the West are mostly below the level of inflation, just saying. That is certainly not true in Russia. Because interest rates are falling at a slower pace than inflation, the real rate of interest in Russia continues to be very high, and in fact, arguably, is actually going higher. What will probably happen is that sometime, maybe in 2027, we're going to see interest rates fall much more quickly, at which point economic growth will probably restart at a much higher level again. Anyway, you won't find much of this analysis in the media in the West, but that's the truth. The Russian economy is not on the verge of collapse, nor is it, even in my opinion, under any very real strain. And the whole narrative of military Keynesianism that is being peddled in the West has no substantive basis behind it. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say today in this program. Lots of things are going on. Obviously, the focus at the moment is Iran. At some point, however, especially when the Russian offensive comes, which it will, the focus will return to Ukraine. At this point, we will see how quickly the talks, be they in Abu Dhabi or Geneva or wherever, how they will be relegated to a sideshow. Anyway, this is where I finish today. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Also, please remember to check out our Substack site, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.